So welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us on this summer Sunday afternoon and deciding to spend your afternoon hearing about satire rather than watching the World Cup. I'm David Taylor. I teach English at the University of Warwick, and I have a particular interest in satire. And out there in the other room, you'll find an installation, a listening slash voting booth, which is of my conception, though not of my building. I'm not a craftsman. About the early 19th century satirist, radical satirist, William Hone. If you've not had a chance to go out there and listen to some student performers recite some speeches from the trials that that Hone was subjected to in December 1817, then please do find time perhaps afterwards to listen to them. So this debate on the question of must satire offend is cued by the fact that it's just over 200 years now since Hone's trials. Hone published three attacks on the government in 1817, and that those attacks took the form of parodies of the Church of England's liturgy. He was arrested in the summer of 1817 without being told why he was being arrested. He spent 3 months ultimately in prison, and he was tried on three consecutive days for each of his three pamphlets, and he defended himself. And he was tried not on the charge of sedition, or more precisely of seditious libel, as one might expect for someone who'd been attacking the government and also the Prince Regent. He was charged instead with blasphemous libel. Why that was is perhaps open to interpretation, but it seems that the government felt that was perhaps an easier charge on which to get Hone. So Hone defended himself. He was acquitted on each of the three trials in what represents a very significant moment in the histories of the freedom of speech and the freedom of press in this country. So why is the trial important 200 years on? Well, I mean, let's not forget that while, thankfully, at least for the moment, Britain is not in the habit of imprisoning its satirists, that's certainly not the case elsewhere in the world. Just last month, for instance, the satirical vlogger Shadi Abu Zaid was detained, an Egyptian vlogger was detained by the Egyptian authorities. And just a few days ago, the cartoonist Rob Rogers, cartoonist for over 25 years for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, he was fired on Thursday for drawing anti-Trump cartoons as that paper lurched to the right. So, depressingly, how far we've come on since 1817 is a matter of debate. But Hone's trials, I think, also raise some wider and deeper questions for us as well, and are relevant for us in particular ways. And the first of those questions is the question of how satire circulates and how it the kinds of audiences it reaches. So, for the government of the day in 1817. Hone's principal misdemeanor was not really to satirize the government so much as to have done so in really cheap pamphlets that sold for just a few pence, and that therefore were able to and did reach the lower classes that, as the Attorney General argued at the trial, had weak and vulnerable minds. That's a quote, that's what he said, and that couldn't understand what they were being exposed to. And I think it's interesting because in a digital age, as we are now, satire, and especially visual satire, especially cartoons, are circulating in different ways. They're crossing the borders of cultures and nations in new and powerful and sometimes problematic ways. And so, as in 1817, we're at a moment when satire's reach and audience are changing, as the media through which satire circulates is changing. The second question I think that Hone's trials raise for us is a question of offence. Hone wasn't as charged with sedition, as I say, but was rather charged with blasphemy. The government used religion and the laws pertaining to religious offence to get at him. And so at the heart of Hone's trials were questions such as, is there a right to offend? Is there a right to be offended? Is the taking of offence a dangerous political weapon in itself. Is offence about intention, about what the satirist intends, or is offence about what an audience take from a satire? Must satire offend, ultimately? And so that's the question we'll be talking about today, and I'm absolutely delighted to have the three speakers here around me to talk about this question. I'll introduce them in order. We'll first hear from Ella Bucknell. Ella is a cartoonist and illustrator, and in June 2017, she founded, very excitingly, a magazine called Whip, which provides a very much needed forum for political cartoons by women. There's been two issues so far, and I've just been hearing there'll probably a third issue later this year. She graduated from Oxford in English literature. Yeah. Way. In 2015, and she's now completing an MA in illustration at Camberwell College of Arts. And very excitingly, I think, she's currently working on a graphic biography of Virginia Woolf. Our second speaker is Martin Rosen, a multi-award-winning cartoonist and writer. And his cartoons, as I'm sure many of you will know, appear very frequently in The Guardian and The Daily Mail. Sorry, not The Daily Mail.
Not the Daily.
Definitely not The Daily Mail. That's a good start. The Daily Mirror. And he's published graphic novelizations of... We can always hope that maybe one day they'll appear in The Daily Mail. Who knows? He's published graphic novelizations of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, and most recently, in fact, I think it just came out last month, didn't it? This graphic adaptation, this amazing graphic adaptation of the Communist Manifesto. Our final speaker is Golam Kiabani, reader in media and communications at Goldsmiths, University of London. And his research centres on media and social change, particularly in the Middle East. As well as on issues of multiculturalism, the culturalization of terror, the rise of the security state, and anti-Muslim racism. And he's author of Iranian Media, The Paradox of Modernity. He's co-author of Blogistan, and he's co-editor of After Charlie Hebdo, Terror, Racism, and Free Speech. So thank you so much, all three of you, for joining us this afternoon. And the way that we'll work the debate is we'll hear from each of our three speakers who'll speak for between 5 to 10 minutes. Then they'll have an opportunity to respond to each other. It will be interesting to see how much they overlap or disagree. And once they've had a chance to respond to each other, we'll open up questions and comments from the floor for people. Okay, thanks. So, Ella, over to you. Thank you.
Hello. So, must satire offend? Well, when I was thinking about this question, I decided that there are two conditions which determine our answer. The first is our understanding of the nature of satire. What is satire? What effect do we think satire should have? What does satire need to do in order to be effective? And the second is our understanding of the nature of offence. So I'm going to primarily focus on the second condition, but I just wanted to briefly touch on the first. Satire is often reduced to its parts, humour, parody, exaggeration, irony, etc. But it doesn't need to involve these things in order to counter satire. It doesn't need to be funny, although I do think it should usually involve wit of some kind. Tim Parks defines satire as ridicule with a noble motive, so the desire to bring shame on a personal party behaving wrongly or ignorantly. I quite like this definition. I don't think it necessarily holds true for all satire, and it's quite reductive, but I think generally for political cartoons, this seems to fit quite well. So it's kind of mockery with a message. So, secondly, can you mock without offending? Well, rarely, I think. I think people usually, almost always, take offence to mockery. I think perhaps the more important question is, do we think causing offence is the same thing as being offensive? Can I have my first cartoon, please? Thank you. So this is a cartoon by Ella Barron, who's the resident cartoonist at the TLS. And the caption to this is, Theresa May takes us out of the EU. So I was interviewed quite recently with Ella Barron, and we had a discussion about how satirists can portray women without being offensive.
And one thing that she's done here, and which Steve Bell has done in the past, and Nicola Jennings, is use Theresa May's leopard print shoes as a focal point of the satire. I don't think this is sexist, because it's funny, but it doesn't use her body as the joke. But another feminist might take issue. They might say that by focusing on Theresa May's clothes, we're drawing upon a stereotype that all women are obsessed with their clothes, and it's not treating Theresa May as a legitimate political figure. I think that's a valid argument, but in this case, I don't think it's true. I feel like Ella's using the shoes as a metonym for May, which is a recognisable sort of feature for her, and it does address Theresa May's complete slapstick banana slip catastrophe of Brexit negotiations. So we're not always going to agree. But I don't think most people would want this cartoon banned because somebody took offence to it. So, offence is a strong term. Some people claim offence when they've misread the joke or missed the joke, and that may be due to the fault of the cartoonist because they haven't made themselves clear, or it may be the fault of the reader. Other people sometimes use offence as a byword for other emotions. So I could say that I'm offended by Marmite, but it doesn't mean that the rest of society finds Marmite offensive or that Marmite's morally objectionable. In fact, I should probably use the word repulsed rather than offended. And that's not to delegitimise people's right to claim offence, because of course you should protest when you believe something to be wrong. But if causing offence is not always the same thing as being offensive, then how do we as a society judge when something is? So obviously it's a chaotic process, but we do have laws against hate speech in this country. And hate speech is, these laws are contentious because they can conflict with our right to freedom of speech. I don't really want to get into right now whether our right to not receive offensive abuse trumps our right to freedom of speech. I just want to argue that I think, generally, if we can consider a cartoon to be hateful or to incite hate, then as a rule of thumb, we can probably consider it to be offensive. So, must satire offend? Well, insofar as we understand offensiveness to be hate speech, then no, I think satire must not offend. Obviously, it's not always clear-cut. And at the end of the day, before a cartoon might need to be trialled as hate speech, then it's at the satirists and editors and publishers' discretion to decide whether it's too offensive to publish or draw. So the satirist has to ask themselves, is my cartoon hateful? Do I use derogatory stereotypes? And do I sacrifice the morality of the piece for the joke? Is this ridicule with a noble motive? They might also ask, am I punching up or down? They might ask, am I gratuitously attacking an already marginalised group? So can I have my next cartoon, please? Thank you. This is an example of what I think is a good cartoon. So it's satirising white feminism. And the man says, why do you have to call it feminism? We all deserve equality, and the term makes me feel left out. You should be an equalist or humanist. And the white woman says, because the continued disenfranchisement of women needs to be addressed specifically. And in the next frame, the white woman says, why do you need black feminism? It should just be feminism. Why would you divide us like that? And the black woman says, really? So I feel like this does mock the white woman, or white feminism in general, but it's not hateful. So I think it works quite well. It just exposes a hypocrisy, is what I meant to say. I think some people think that society's increased sensitivity to what we deem to be hateful or offensive is scuppering satire's comic effectiveness. I don't think that this is true. I think that satirists just have to be a bit cleverer and funnier and more switched on than before. So a cheap sexist joke isn't going to get a laugh anymore. And that's not tyrannical feminism attacking freedom of speech. It's just that this type of satire is hateful and unfunny. So satire must not be offensive, and it must not aim to offend. But I do also want to say that I believe that no topic should be off limits to the satirist. All belief systems and power structures should be open to the scrutiny of satirical critique. And the satirist shouldn't have to work in fear of causing offence. Of course, people will be upset when their belief systems and behaviours are challenged, but challenging behaviours and belief systems isn't ever offensive in and of itself. So, yeah, I think this is how we make change happen, basically. And George Orwell says, every joke is a tiny revolution. Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks. Martin, do you want... there's a clicker here if you want
to... Thank you. If I get up and walk around, I hope you can still hear me and it's still recording. And is my...
Yeah, if you come on, one more.
Oh, there we go. Now, on the subject of offence I've always maintained is in the eye of the beholder. And I am offended by almost everything, which is why I'm a satirist. I'm offended by the power structures of all our world, I'm offended by the inequalities of wealth, I'm offended by the injustices given to people, not because of what they think, but, okay, thank you very much, not because of what they think, because it's all. Not because of what they think, but because of what they are. I don't do that kind of thing. I subscribed to H.R. Mencken's definition of journalism, which is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. So I only attack people more powerful than me, and I only attack people because of what they think. However, I also exist in that strange hinterland between humour and satire. Satire is a subset of humour. Humour is a human survival mechanism. Clever geneticists have traced back the laughter gene in primates 6 million years. We, however, are the only primates that uses mockery as a social control. We do it to attract people, to repel them, to most of all make life bearable as we navigate our way through it to our ultimate deaths by laughing at the things which would otherwise drive us insane with existentialist terror. So we laugh at our leaders, we laugh at death, we laugh at sex, we laugh at shit, we laugh at each other. And I think these are sort of fundamentally important things, which is why we laugh at bodily functions. And this cartoon, which I did 25 years ago, when it was revealed that the then Princess of Wales was suffering from bulimia, is actually directly offensive. It was meant to be offensive. It was in that kind of sort of yarboo, rolling around in the gutter, let's see how shocking we can be, school of humour. It's not satirical, it's just a nasty joke. And of course, the worst part of it was persuading her to swallow a bottle of champagne for lunch. And when this was published in Time Out, the following week, the letters pages were filled with people who wanted to have me publicly castrated and my children killed. Which is pretty offensive, actually, to have me publicly castrated and my children killed, because they were only very small at the time. They probably deserve it now, but not then. Although I felt somewhat relieved the following week when they published a letter from somebody saying, I am a bulimic, I thought Martin Rosen's cartoon was very funny, I cut it out and stuck it on the front of my fridge. Think about that for a moment. This one, again, is more satirical, but it is verging into the... It's still in the realm of just toilet humour, and we all engage in toilet humour. The kind of human sense of humour is typified by this noise... which will make any child under the age of one laugh, because it's the noise the shit makes when it pours out of your body on a daily basis. If we didn't laugh at it, we'd go insane with horror. Just think about it. And when the International Olympics Committee at the time of the 2012 Olympics said that any unauthorized use of the Olympic rings would be met with the full majesty of copyright law, it was just too much of a temptation. So here we have a five-arse pig terrorizing London with turds with the logos of the main sponsors pouring out of its five arses, in the hope that they would sue me, because it would be great as a test case to actually test the boundaries of satire, and we could have had a veterinary proctologist come in there with a real five-arsed pig, and we could talk about these things seriously. But of course, as I said, offence is in the eye of the beholder to a large extent, and I agree with everything that Ella said about how you need to hold elites to account by using this inbuilt human facility for mockery. This was a cartoon I did at the... during the first leadership election, Labour leadership election during 2015, when the United States had finally recognised Castro's Cuba. So there's John Kerry hugging Fidel. So Cold War ends, Claude War continues. And here we see the various candidates for the Labour Party leadership. There is Yvette Cooper pulling her head in half and her brain falling out. The Blairite, whose name I've forgotten now, looking in horror at a pink flag. Andy Burnham as Noddy going round and round in circles. And here is Jeremy Corbyn having his leg chewed by the severed skull of Tony Blair. And on the comments below the line on the Guardian website, somebody said, this disgraceful Blairite cartoon continuing the Guardian's hateful attack on Jeremy Corbyn. And occasionally I go and play in traffic and I just sort of commented a few seconds. I love coming on this forum because it's just so much about the indomitability of the human spirit. I'm so pleased there are so many clinically blind posters coming on here to give us their opinion of this cartoon. Several posts down saying, "How dare you? Until my operation 2 years ago, I was clinically blind." In a way, you get the feeling that people are crying out to be offended because it is a marvelous badge of victimhood. And victimhood is used by oppressors throughout history and throughout the world. The biggest victims of all time, in their own minds, were the Nazis. Again, there are taboos which will cause offence, but of course we laugh at death to make it bearable. But some people think it's a taboo to even mention death. So this was after the death of Steve Jobs, a profoundly unpleasant man. When he became the CEO of Apple, again in, I think, 1999, he cancelled all their charitable subscriptions. He beckoned his own death by refusing to listen to any medical advice. But I thought this was actually quite a neat way of covering his death. So instead of a coffin, you've got an iPad. In the comments below the line, again, after a while, there was somebody, "The man is not yet cold in the ground," and you do this disgraceful, offensive cartoon about him, because they objected to the grief app down there. Until somebody posted a link to the official Apple grief app, which you could download onto your tablet device, of a flickering candle which you could hold up outside the Apple store as you brushed away a tear for this profoundly unpleasant man who managed to realise we're such a bunch of dumb fucking marmosets we had to buy his trinkets in order to mediate reality. And of course it's not just individual people who are offended and who you must be offended on behalf of. Even if they're dead, you have to be offended on behalf of your imaginary sky friends as well. So a religion is, of course, always a time when people will be offended. I thought this was actually rather an affectionate and rather a sweet cartoon to do after the death of John Paul II. I got death threats for this. I mean, I genuinely literally got death threats for this cartoon. And of course, in the turmoil of taunt and counter-taunt, of offence and counter-offence, every time in the last 25 years of my professional career, 30 years of my professional career, I've done a cartoon even remotely approaching the subject of the State of Israel or the actions of the government of the State of Israel, I have instantly been denounced for anti-Semitism. And it's a very clever tactic, because it means that I've been offensive and therefore I should shut up. I've committed a terrible thing. And anti-Semitism is a terrible thing. I don't think I am an anti-Semite. I did this cartoon during the Gazan flotilla, I think in 2010, which was stopped by Israeli forces. And there's a guy who ran a website called CIF Watch, looking out for any anti-Semitism appearing in The Guardian, and said this was a grossly anti-Semitic cartoon because it depicted a biblical story. And I thought I'd go and play in traffic again, so I said, actually, no. Noah, strictly speaking, is pre-Abrahamic, therefore he's not even Jewish. So how is it anti-Semitic? He said, well, it's clearly anti-Semitic because you are deploying animals mentioned in the Bible. I mean, first of all, I don't understand how that's anti-Semitic. But secondly, could you please give me chapter and verse precisely where in the Bible it is mentioned the alpaca, the walrus, the aardvark, the beaver, the wallaby, and indeed the okapi, first described to science in 1901. At which point this person replied, that's irrelevant. I said, no, the elephant's at the back. Thank you very much. I'm here all week. As I said, it's a gambit. It's a tactic, and it's a very successful gambit and tactic. Not getting the joke is always the way to diffuse the joke. The joke is an attack. It is mockery. If you don't get it, you diffuse it to a certain extent. But of course, what do you do when people burst into your humorous magazine in Paris shouting Allahu Akbar as they fire off automatic weapons, first of all killing the janitor, a man called Frederick Boiseau, whose name we should not forget, in the Charlie Hebdo killings. After that, I wanted to respond in a specific way. I didn't want to do just another YOY cartoon. I wanted to do something which would outmaneuver the Islamophobes. And so I originally proposed doing a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad with his head in his hands, so you couldn't see his face, wearing a Not In My Name t-shirt. And The Guardian published my work. I'm not self-publishing. They pay me. So I gave them a lot of notice so they could discuss this at higher reaches of the paper. And I entirely respect the decision they finally came to, which was this might endanger the lives of Guardian staff in the Middle East. It would have certainly possibly endangered my life. I would probably have had to go into hiding. I had to check this with my family beforehand. My children, who were in their 20s, said, yes, that's okay, although my son did then send me an email saying, if you do get assassinated, can I be the person to do it, which I thought was rather sweet of him. And in the end, I didn't do it. I did this cartoon instead, which I think is actually slightly better. So I described the cartoon I was going to do. Well, now, Space Cats, here's my cartoon of Muhammad wearing a Not In My Name t-shirt, except that some of my loved ones, rather bizarrely, don't want me to risk getting murdered, affording a few of you lot a wry smile. Weird, huh? And as a consequence, over the subsequent weekend, thousands of people on social media were accusing me of being the worst coward in the history of cowardice. So over there, there are people who are so offended that they will kill janitors and geriatric cartoonists in an incredibly soft mafia hit. So they'll kill people because they're offended. And there are people over there who are offended by the fact that I'm refusing to be offensive and want me to be prepared to die. And you get into a where it's almost impossible to do anything without actually offending. Whether the intention is to offend or not becomes irrelevant. So, when I created this rather cuddly shark, Wonga the Lone Shark, it's a nice friendly cartoon character with nice big teeth. Every time Wonga the Lone Shark appeared in a cartoon of mine, I get this individual emailing me and commenting on the Guardian website about this disgraceful depiction of these harassed creatures of the deep, and how dare I do this when hundreds of thousands of them were slain every year to meet the requirements of Chinese cuisine, and how dare I compare them to a human being? And he was being offended on behalf of sharks. And if a shark objects to my work, it can presumably show its critique in its own uniquely sharky way. Now, that's a quite bizarre and, you know, ridiculous thing, but it gets even worse. A year ago yesterday, Joe Cox was murdered on the streets of this country by an English Nazi. And I did this cartoon in response to that, and also in response to the murders earlier that week in Orlando. And I'm rather pleased with it. It's called Lone Wolves, and it's how these people are called lone wolves, but they're getting fed this poison through what we have created, this external id for humanity called the internet, filled with the worst mad, theoretic ravings that we used to keep inside our skulls, and we now pour out onto a keyboard because we don't understand they're going around the world forever. And my friend and colleague Nick Cohen tweeted, you know, just occasionally Rosen does a cartoon which sticks in the mind, this is one of those. Somebody tweeted underneath it, don't you think it gives a very negative portrayal of wolves and other canid species? So we get to the point where you actually can't offend wolves. You can't offend anybody, and yet I am constantly offended. I am constantly offended by the media in this country who whips up hatred, ceaselessly whips up hatred, endangering my fellow citizens. So when a madman attacked Finsbury Mosque last year, and this is almost exactly a year ago, in fact, exactly a year ago, and I was trying to do something about Grenfell, but I was so depressed and offended by Grenfell that I thought, let's just do this. Let's go for the obvious gag. That is the van he was driving. And I just wrote, and I did almost exact copy of the photograph of it waiting to be examined by the forensic officers, saying, read the Sun and the Daily Mail. 2 days later, the Daily Mail, which is why I'm not going to be published by them anytime soon, ran this full-page editorial about how disgraceful that cartoon was and how I was defaming the good, kind, sweet people of the Daily Mail, how I was disgusting, deranged, sick, and offensive. Words I will have carved into my tombstone with a quotation from the Daily Mail when I finally die, probably in about 20 minutes' time. And everybody is seeking to be offended. So almost the words of the motion are meaningless because everybody will find something to be offended by because it empowers them. And this was a cartoon I did, again, about a year ago, of the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the Battle of Passchendaele. Nobody personally involved with the Battle of Passchendaele is still alive. Nobody who fought in that battle is still alive. Somebody said, this must be the worst taste cartoon, worst taste and most offensive cartoon of all time. Not even that afternoon. Not even of that afternoon. You want to see the worst taste and most offensive cartoon of all time? Yeah, you want to see it? Okay, this one. I did this specifically at the invitation of the editor of an underground American comic who said, just think up the worst thing you possibly can in your head and then draw it, which I did. And there it is, and I published it on Twitter when Trump got elected. I left it there for 5 minutes, during which time the man who currently lives in Castle Howard, which is what the set they used for the TV production of Brideshead Revisited, saw it, bought the original, which now hangs up in the public rooms of Brideshead. So that's, I think that's a little victory. That's a little victory for giving the great gift of offence, which I don't seek to do. I seek to empower people to laugh at what is already offensive. And if people are offended by that, as far as I'm concerned, for the most part, it's because they are originally defending the offensive. However, nonetheless, you've got to have a laugh. And a few years ago, I was invited to the Larne Festival in South Wales, Larne, where Dylan Thomas lived, and I was specifically enjoined and commissioned to produce this mural opposite the Three Mariners pub where Dylan Thomas used to drink himself into oblivion every night. And there it is. It's an imitation of the Cerne Abbas giant, the Larne Dylan giant, with his erect phallus replaced by a bottle of whiskey. And this was hosed off the wall within 48 hours as an outrage to public decency. And I cannot say that my heart didn't sing with joy knowing that I've still got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Golem.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really not ashamed to say that I'm kind of, in a way, out of my depth here, sitting between two practitioners and one expert. And in what I wanted to do, actually, rather than kind of, in a way, spending any time on kind of, in a way, on the question of the satire itself, rather open up the discussions by kind of, in a way, perhaps making the debate a little bit more complicated. That's what apparently academics are supposed to do, since we can't do the actual thing itself. So, of course, I think, in the first place, when actually David contacted me and raised the questions, would I be interested? And I said, yeah, of course. And this is quite obviously a very provocative question, and I think it's done. My guess is actually on purpose, and there are many good, I would suggest, both historical as well as recent kind of, in a way, reason to kind of, in a way, raise it. And especially in recent times, I think Martin has given some amazing examples, and so has Ella, in relation to how, in particular, the kind of, in a way, question of actually causing offence or giving offence or, in fact, even actually taking offence has become kind of, in a way, pretty much kind of, in a way, linked with the idea of the basic human rights and more or less inseparable, kind of, in a way, conjoined with the idea of the freedom of speech. And many people have argued that's exactly where there should not be any limits by any means. And I think Ella somehow kind of, in a way, alluded to that notion and idea as well. And in fact, for a number of people actually written on this subject, satire has come to be kind of, in a way, regarded as a very high manifestation of the freedom of speech itself. Recently, some of the works on this subject, for example, Brian Winston, in a detailed studies of attacks on freedom of speech, which explores a whole range of examples from 16th century to the fatwa against Salman Rushdie in the late 1980s to the recent hacking scandal in the UK, has charted and actually mapped some of those kind of, you know, more offensive, and in fact, actually, the title of the book itself is A Right to Offend, even though it's about freedom of speech, the title is actually about the right to offend. Caspar Melville, another author who has written on the question of actually offense, called Taking Offense, in a rather different context, also suggested that, and I'm quoting here, giving offense is essential if society is to challenge its orthodoxies and put power, I think that emphasis is quite important, under proper scrutiny. And of course, the right to offense, especially since that absolutely insane and murderous attacks on Charlie Hebdo has become even more so synonymous with the idea of the kind of, in a way, offending and the right to offend. I think I kind of, in a way, agree with the point that Ella raised, that to some extent, satire is effectively, by definition, is to do with offense, since it is to do with the use of humor, using the basic and pretty well-known definition of the use of humor, irony, exaggeration, or ridicule, to expose and criticize people's stupidity or vices. And this can be, in so many cases, kind of, in a way, offensive, at least to some individuals or perhaps to some other groups. Some other authors, for example, Leon Hunt, have also, by looking at the kind of, in a way, occult British comedies in the UK in recent years, have suggested this is kind of, in a way, pretty much given and natural, since he suggests that since satires offer no analysis, I think actually that is wrong. Satire do offer amazing analysis, and actually many of the cartoons, in one little image, you get a much better analysis than pages and pages and pages of commentary. But anyway, this is what he says. Since satire offers no analysis and much less solutions to the problem identified, it makes it even more likely to being misread, divisive, and open to accusation of making light of something which is quite serious and important. And I think, again, Martin actually raised some really, really important points around those issues. And this is precisely when we see the tension between creative freedom and the human dignity, between a right to free speech and acceptable boundaries, and also the line between what is right and what might be a straightforward bullying and intimidation of certain individuals or certain groups. There isn't that much kind of, in a way, a time for me to kind of, in a way, go into the various aspects of it, but I'm not going to chicken out after the actual kind of, in a way, answer, but what I want to do, as I suggested, kind of, in a way, raise a number of questions, because I think the question itself needs further clarification and perhaps can be supplemented and complemented with some additional kind of, in a way, questions. Let me focus on two significant areas. The first point I wanted to raise that in my own response and in locating my own response in the context of the free speech or a right to offend, as some people have increasingly come to kind of, in a way, call it, I want to suggest that the question of must satire be offensive in itself rather silent on exactly who satire and offensive to whom. Yes, I think that's a very important question. If a right to offend implies that there are individuals who have or must have this right, i.e. the right to offend, the question is, who are they exactly? Various rights, if you look at kind of in which are the history of this debate, such as rights of man, women's right, or even animals' right, give some kind of, in a way, names to the holders of these specific rights. But in this particular case, the subject and the object of offense is absent or not clear, or at least in many cases is not clear. Let me elaborate on kind of in a way on this point by raising two rather important historical kind of in a way issues. We are all familiar, of course, I'm sure many of us actually have seen it so many times in the Hollywood movies, the famous sentence in Declaration of the Independence in the United States, which was written in 1776. This is the famous second sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creatures with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The particular author of this sentence, namely Thomas Jefferson, and the people actually who supported this rather well-known, and I would suggest even magnificent kind of, in a way, treaty and sentence, of course themselves had absolutely no problem with denying the very same right, the right to life, the right to liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to a fantastically large number of populations, Native Americans and their slaves later on. Yeah? That's one significant paradox for us. We also see similar sentiment and principles in another key founding text, and I would also suggest a majestic kind of, in a way, text, a quite inspirational text, and that is the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizens in France in 1789, 30 years after the US Declaration. And again, here is the sentence. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions can be founded only on the common good. Needless to say, from that period to the day that actually women got the right to vote after the Second World War, it took around 150 years. So exactly when we're talking about equality and the right, who is it exactly that has the right? Who is the holder of that right? That's again another kind of, in a way, paradox, interesting paradox for us. What I'm trying to highlight here is actually the problem with established assumptions about who exactly counts as a subject of rights, who has it, and who hasn't got access to it. I think for everyone to have the right, they first must be recognized as part of a political community, or to use the kind of, in a way, famous sentence by Hannah Arendt the famous chapter 9 of The Origins of Totalitarianism. She talks about a right to have rights. And in particular, actually, she's quite concerned, having experienced that kind of, in a way, status as a stateless refugee, trying to get out of the Nazi Germany, kind of, in a way, saying how important it is for actually for people to have a right in order to have a right, to be regarded as part of the community, to be recognized as part of, kind of, in a way, that community. And here let me give you a rather well-known example. It's of course nothing to do with a satire, but a line which has been repeated in many ways, in many humorous ways, again and again and again in recent times, and that is Katie Hopkins' descriptions of refugees as a cockroaches. It was offensive, and the intention was precisely to shock and to offend. As a member of political community, I, citizen of Britain, of course, one could suggest she has the right to offend, and not only has the right to offend, but also given the platform to offend and to shock. And in fact, I'm guessing she was paid handsomely for it. But then the question actually arises, what are those stateless refugees who have no claim to rights, who cannot have that possible problems, who are actually not paid in order to respond or kind of anyway have the right to reply? So what's happened to their claims of right, to their liberty, and so on and so forth? I think in many cases, if we try to kind of open up the discussions, and something that Ella has done and a number of other people, if there is a question of actually access, something which we can perhaps come back to in relation to the flourishing of online kind of, in a way, platforms and the new forms of pamphlets online. What about actually women and minorities and so on and so forth? How they kind of, in a way, equate that, and we can locate them in a much kind of, in a broader historical context, the people who didn't have the right to even actually express themselves, let alone offend other people. So that's the first point I wanted to raise. The second point, I think, again, pretty much kind of in a way broad, is that if the task of the satire is to call into question the dominant ethical structures of any society, then we can claim that satire has a close link with the value systems, and I think actually Martin and Ella pointed that actually quite clearly. And in that respect, it's quite kind of important to look at that value system and ask, what is it exactly that being rejected and resisted, and what the satire in that particular case stands for? Who is being offended? Who is being comforted? And again, for what purposes? In relation, again, going back to the actual questions, I want to insist on that important kind of, in a way, context, because it's kind of, in a way, quite crucial and important precisely how people kind of, in a way, get to really, really see a critical cartoon as being anti-Semitic, or a critical cartoon being kind of, in a way, a sign of cruelty to sharks or animals broadly, and so on and so forth. So that kind of, in a way, context is quite kind of, in a way, important and crucial. And part of this context, you might actually argue, has to do, going back to the issues that was raised initially by David, has to do with the question of actually temporalities of those rights, exactly when they came about, under what context, under what conditions, and so on and so forth. But also of our own sensitivities, our own constantly shifting and changing attitudes, as well as kind of in a way level of inclusivity in many many cultures and many societies. I mean, some of the stuff which has been banned historically in the UK and elsewhere, a music video, a novel or something, you kind of in a way go back and look at it and say, on what planet they really kind of in a way could come to argue that, let's say, Lady Chatterley Lover was kind of in a way repulsive, offensive, or a video by, was it Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which was kind of in a way, or Monty Python Life of Brian. I mean, anybody in my view who cannot actually sit with a massive bowl of popcorn and enjoy that film again and again and again, I might actually have a little bit of a problem with the idea of the humor itself. But nevertheless, these are the things which actually generated controversy. And now we're sitting here looking at, back at those examples, and you find it really, really ridiculous that those things should have been subject of such a kind of, in a way, intense debate. So that, I think, that kind of, in a way, context and temporal elements of the context is kind of, in a way, quite important. But I would also suggest the other crucial context here is the fundamental contradictions between a society which is based on equality before the law, when and if that law exists, and when, if that law is actually available for everybody, and a society based on a significant degree of inequality, something which again actually Martin pointed out to. So we are talking, or we're sitting at a time in which 8 individuals, according to a recent report by Oxfam, own as much wealth as half of the world's population. I mean, that to me seems to be the biggest offense that we are currently facing. So we have that. And in that context, I think it makes sense to ask if satire job is to go after easy targets and kick down refugees, minority people, disabled, and so on and so forth, or direct its sharp tongue and anger higher up the chain. I think I'm going to finish here.
Thanks very much. Thank you. So perhaps just a few minutes, if any of the panelists want to respond to one another before we open it up to the floor.
I think we're in broad agreement, as I expected we would be.
I'm disappointed.
One thing that you just hinted at was I think this idea of rights and equality before the law, and in a way, the offence agenda is another liberal sop just to keep people quiet. You know, so to a certain extent, a bit like multiculturalism, we'll give you shit jobs, but you can wear nice clothes. And it's the democratisation of lèse majesté, that everybody is empowered to be offended. So nobody's allowed to say anything about anybody in case it upsets them. And one of the things I was alluding to about the dangers of social media is that it has allowed these two contradictory thoughts to inhabit the heads of everybody on earth, and we have these skulls to keep this mad garbage inside and it pours out. But that, first of all, I should be allowed to say whatever I want, whatever I choose about whoever I feel like. And secondly, I myself must never be upset. And people maintain those two truths in their head at the same time. So you get people like Katie Hopkins, who is clearly deeply, deeply upset by people being even slightly different to her, being anywhere else on the planet. And that's her problem. That's why she's so upset and she says these truly offensive and vile things, which I'm offended by, but as I said, I'm not saying people shouldn't be offended because the whole basis of my career is offence. I'm offended by things.
Do you want to say anything?
Well, I suppose I think we are in agreement, but we're defining offence, not defining offence in a different way, but I think I was trying to argue that offence isn't always in the eye of the beholder, whereas I think you're arguing that it is, so therefore satire must offend. Is that right?
If you can tease out the kernel of my argument, well done to you.
Okay.
I think what I'm saying is that there are certain things are offensive, certain things are fundamentally offensive. There are philosophers who will argue that it is not offensive to argue that people should have the right to rape babies, but everybody else would disagree with that. And people advocating that just offend everybody. What I'm also saying is at the same time, people will take the fact that there is this notion of offence and they will use it proactively as an aggressive weapon. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the receiving end of this across the political spectrum. I mean, just absolutely everybody. And when the shark fanciers and the dog lovers came after me, that was after the atheists came after me because apparently I was being offensive about Richard Dawkins.
I suppose my question for you is, when The Guardian stopped you or didn't publish the image of Muhammad which you wanted to draw, did you feel like that was censorship, or did you feel...
No, I felt it was the end of a careful and deliberative editorial process.
Yeah.
As I said, I don't self-publish, and I entirely respect their view, and that wasn't censorship, that was editorial judgment. And they were thinking about the safety of their staff.
Yeah.
And it would have been a big... And I probably would have had to go into hiding. So I was rather relieved not to do that. Yeah. No, my point about that story was the fact that all these people were apparently offended by my failure to be offensive.
There were two issues which I wanted to raise. One, actually, in relation to the point that Ella raised, that there are no limits. I would suggest it depends again on the context. I mean, under no circumstances, well, perhaps there are circumstances, I would kind of anyway assume that, let's say, mocking a victim of a rape, gang rape, let's say in India, which has been kind of anyway frequent occurrences, can be really a good topic for satire. Unless you kind of anyway find a kind of anyway really nice angle to it, in which actually kind of anyway really makes fun of the Indian state's attitude and the level of kind of gender equality, I would also suggest something which has come up again and again and again. I mean, to what extent can we really make fun of Holocaust? Mm. And so there are, I think, areas which are quite sensitive for good historical reasons, which perhaps, if not actually makes them off-limit, requires exactly that editorial judgment. Yeah. And I wouldn't call that kind of anyway as censorship as such. I mean, every single one of us, every single morning, from the moment you wake up, you go to take the London Underground to go to work, you're being pushed around, the tube is crowded, you have to queue behind somebody who takes ages to take their penny out in order to pay for their coffee. You're constantly kind of in a way pushed to say something, and you always suppress yourself. I think there is a kind of a new degree of humanity, not responding right there or then. because you're annoyed somebody's kind of slowing down, whether it's an old lady or kind of a little child or a woman with a pram or a disabled person. I think I wouldn't call that kind of censorship, because most of us do exercise that on a regular basis from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed. And part of the problem I think we have now with this hoo-ha around social media is actually the sort of stuff that perhaps me and David could talk about privately. And David said, Colm, I think that's really absurd and that's very offensive, you know. And I would say, oh, sorry, I wasn't kind of being thoughtful. But once you put it on Twitter, once you put it on Facebook, once you put it on kind of social media, this really private thought, which emerge at 2 o'clock in the morning after you coming back from pubs and having a few drinks, suddenly becomes a kind of significant.
I think that's actually very important. It's something which people don't talk about, that in the last 20 years we've had the complete dissolution of the Chinese wall which existed between public and private discourse. So, for example, if you look at 20 years ago, the death of Diana, and if those of us old enough will remember that people were publicly emoting in the streets, there was this national outpouring of grief, which I didn't mock. I thought that was an entirely reasonable thing for people to do. They wanted to be magnificently sad. At the same time, exactly the same people were doing, as people always have done, telling the most appallingly sick jokes about the death of Diana in private. But now people don't do things in private anymore. They tell appallingly sick jokes, and it is, first of all, published. Secondly, it is there forever. Thirdly, it is universal. And they said, oh, you're suppressing my freedom of speech. No, I'm actually exerting my freedom not to have to listen to this shit, which is something which we forget about. We should actually have that freedom not to have to listen to this shit.
I suppose, just going back to what you were saying about whether any topic should be off limits, I think, obviously, you could do a really careful satire which does have a sort of noble motive about certain very sensitive topics, but it's a satirist's job to judge whether that is just too insensitive at the time and in the context and in the situation. But you have to be able to think about how to do those sorts of things, because as you've done, responding to horrible terrorist attacks or like Grenfell, and I think some of the cartoons that came out of some of those tragedies were sensitive, and I'm sure not everybody agreed, but I didn't find them offensive in that context. So they don't necessarily have to be offensive as such or hateful. They can still have a noble motive, but it's just a judgment call, really.
There's a lot of it which is in the eye of the beholder, as I said, because after 9/11, which let us remember as the most visual event in human history, people had no problem seeing 3,000 people there. Bits of those 3,000 people billowing into the streets of Manhattan. But cartoonists around the world had a terrible time. And I couldn't work out why this was. You know, there were cartoonists in America being sacked, some of them being visited in the middle of the night under the meaning of the Patriot Act. Cartoonists over here saying, don't deal with this topic. I was given a hard time for even covering it because people thought it was meant to be funny and it wasn't cartoons. Not all cartoons are funny, nor do they have to be. And I couldn't work out what it was that was wrong about our visualization of it, as opposed to the other visualization, you're watching it on TV all the time. Then I realized it's because these other images were captured by machines, whereas we'd actually filtered it through our consciousness. So satire, particularly cartoons, are a fundamentally human response to things, unmediated by machinery. And in a way, that's why we get so much grief. That's why people respond so badly, because we've thought about what we're doing, and also they consume it, rather than nibbling through the text that the cartoon squats on top of, they consume it whole, as floods through their eyes and goes straight to the reptile brain. Mm. So it is in the eye of the beholder, to a very large extent, how offended you are. You probably wouldn't be offended by reading the same stuff. I don't know.
I want to open it up to the floor now. There's lots of kind of interesting questions, I think, that have been raised. And just to kind of recap them before I open up. You know, I think what Ella's been saying about hatefulness, and how do we define offence? If we define offence as something being hateful, and that's something that Ella's argued she would want to distance satire from, and Martin, who's talked about offence in the eye of the beholder, but also what's begun to emerge from Martin's comments, and ultimately from everybody's, is the way that the game has changed in the digital age, the way that you're going, delving rather bravely into the comment sections on your own cartoons. And then Golem raising some really important questions about those people who actually don't really, who are kind of disenfranchised from the world of comment and satire, refugees, for instance, being a kind of good case in point, and also raising that really important question, which also ties into this issue of the digital era, of the kind of temporality of satire, of, you know, the thinking that these questions, this question of satire, this question of offence, is quite it's historically specific. What will be offensive changes at any given moment in time. What's interesting listening to all of you is that, but perhaps most especially you, Martin, is that the idea that offence is something that the audience determine, but that you also have your own, your last comment there really got to that point very clearly, which was that you've thought through what you're doing very carefully, so that you have an intention. Yes. You have an intention. You know what you want to mock. But then, you know, how important is it for other people? Is it vital that people understand that intention?
Before you throw it up, can I just tell a wonderfully instructive story about cartoons and their power to offend? About the late Stephen Hawking, who about 10 years ago got pneumonia and was rushed into Addenbrooke's Hospital. And Rick Brooks, the pocket cartoonist for the Metro paper, did a cartoon of him slumped in his electric wheelchair with a doctor and nurse standing on either side of him, one saying to the other one, have we tried switching him off and switching him back on again? And on social media, this you can see this groundswell, this sort of wave beginning to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the more and more people were going to lynch Rick digitally. They were going to destroy him. They were going to make him lose his job. And then Stephen Hawking ruined everybody's fun by buying the original. And that's what humour's about. It's, you know, you say the worst thing imaginable to your best friends. The people you hate the most will be offended by the least offensive thing. And it's just part and parcel of how we interconnect with each other.
That's a great story. And I think, again, this is a question of who, also one of the big questions I think that's come out from what the three speakers have said is a question of, you know, who's satire speaking to? As much as how satire speaking, you know, who are you trying to reach? Who are you not trying to reach?
I'm trying to empower people to laugh at the betters.
Right. That's what
I'm
doing. Right. Okay. Enough for me. Questions for the floor. I think there's a microphone that's going to rove at the back. If people have questions, we've got one there.
Okay. It's just picking up off the last comment. I'm just wondering about situations where the subject of the satire becomes emboldened or actively benefits from being the subject of the satire. Is that a danger in that trying to mock and bring someone down? They actually...
Yeah, I mean, it happens. It happens all the time, and it always has happened. It happened to John Wilkes in the 18th century when Hogarth pilloried him in a notorious print, which was meant to be a kind of dark voodoo to sort of destroy him as this kind of devilish satire. And all the Wilkesians just broke the Copyright Act, which Hogarth was responsible for bringing in, by just reproducing it over and over again. So Wilkes became the most well-known man in an age before photography, just through his image. Likewise, Harold Macmillan was portrayed in a demeaning way as a crap superhero, as Super Mac, by Vicky, and Macmillan said, yes, I am, that's me, yes, I'm a superhero. And it's a constant conversation, because cartoons and all other kinds of satire are a kind of elaborate taunt. They're sort of the pant hooting of a chimpanzee trying to taunt another chimpanzee. And one of the ways of dealing with that is to actually take hold of the insult and hug it tight, and then you take possession of it. But it's all about sort of control of the space you're fighting over, you're pant hooting over. And it's in a way, the response of the Daily Mail to my stupid and offensive and disgusting and sick and deranged cartoon should have been just to ignore it. And so everybody at The Guardian, very quietly, without saying it out loud, thought, yes, we've made Dacre blink. We've upset Dacre. Hooray. You know, because that's the point of it. That is the point of it. And he does the same thing to us, or did the same thing to us.
I think just to add to that, another example is John O'Farrell, who used to write for Spitting Image, has said that he didn't think that if Boris Johnson had such a platform on Have I Got News For You, that he would have ever been in the running to become Prime Minister. So I do think it is a difficulty with satire. And I think as you said, Boris embraces the joke because he's already so ridiculous that it doesn't
He creates the joke. He doesn't write jokes about himself, but that's why he behaves the way he does, to get the joke in first, so you're laughing with him rather than at him.
Yeah, so I think it is a danger. And as you say, it's a careful negotiation.
I would suggest also, I think Trump is a kind of, in a way, classic example. Mm-hmm. Everybody has been laughing at him since the moment he emerged. And I'm sorry to say, but the laugh has been on us. It's one of those kind of, I'm not suggesting because of the satirist, he's in a position, but sometimes, as you rightly say, they embrace it and they try to turn it for their own purposes and promote themselves.
But somebody who wakes up every morning and also happens to be the President of the United States of America, and the first thing he does on a Sunday morning is stop tweeting about his portrayal on Saturday Night Live the night before, is not somebody who is impervious to satire, I feel. Mm. It doesn't make any difference, but, you know, where does satire ever make any difference? It's not meant to do that, it's just meant to make us feel better, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Another question. I've got one at the front here.
In your university in Goldsmiths, there was a discussion... a meeting, I think, called by the Atheist Society, very young society at that time, and they invited an ex-Muslim, Mariam Namazi, to get the killings of people for blasphemy, including a lot of cartoonists and so on across the world. And I think the response of people who came to it was complained about before she arrived by the Islamic Society, and a number of them came to the meeting and said she was damaging their safe space, which I think was slightly satirizing themselves, while they were making threats to her and to other people who were supporting her in the meeting. And this became quite famous. But, you know, that partly addresses one of the issues that I think I get very nervous when people start talking about don't punch down. I think Katie Hopkins isn't a satirist. I think she is full of hate. I think we agree with that. But there is a wiping out of the space of minorities within minorities to talk about things that are killing them. And we are told not to do that. So I just wondered what your comment was, all of you actually, about that.
Good question.
Shall I think that is a very, very interesting kind of, in a way, example. And I agree there are significant issues. And again, this is very, very... I would suggest, sorry for being boring, it's very context specific. I mean, in this particular kind of in way time, there are two issues. One, that increasingly there is pressure to kind of in way really create safer spaces, and safer spaces actually has meant limiting to a significant degree from different angles the spaces which are there for debate. So suddenly something which back in the 1970s emerged, and for good reason, and with a particular reference to the fascist organizations as a no-platforming kind of in a way people, has been expanded to almost everybody that we know, yes? So let's say in that particular case, somebody coming, and there is an issue over that. Jermaine Greer was last year in Cardiff University. There was a whole range of hoo-ha, whatever your position on that. Again, there was kind of in a way significant debates around that. So the debates within universities, as well as so many other kind of in a way public spaces, has become a little bit problematic. So the issue is, how are we going to kind of in a way tackle that? I would not, I mean, for my kind of in a way opinion, I would actually not kind of in a way really call Mariam Namazi a minority within the minority. She is not in Iran, she's here. She's actually talking about kind of in a way particular experience of Iran in a very, very particular context, which is happening in the UK. It's not to deny that there are a significant kind of in a way degree of development taking place. But I would suggest, I mean, if you really wanted to flag up the issues of the minority in Iran and raise it up in this country, at this particular moment, you're not gonna create, let's say, a society for ex-Muslims, yeah? If you really, really wanna flag that up, you're gonna create a society for Baha'i Iranians, which are a persecuted minority, have no right to education, have no right to the kind of, in ways, civil rights, basic human rights, and so on and so forth.
Muslims are a minority among Muslims.
I understand that. I'm kind of, in a way, talking as an Iranian in exile. I've never had a particular kind of, in a way, like for the current regime, never been part of that. Not religious by any sense, if I had to kind of in a way pray to save my life, I probably would fail. I don't know the first thing about the kind of in a way the religion in that sense as such. I understand that, but I think the kind of in a way issue that came, that particular kind of in a way attention that such groups get, also is very, very kind of in a way context specific. That's happening in the context of the UK. That doesn't deny the fact, or I don't kind of in a way really recommend that she should be banned or she should not have any rights. In fact, my arguments with some of our students was actually you should have really behaved, you should have allowed her to speak, raise your hand, and ask some questions. In some other institution, Brunel University, I think they had invited Katie Hopkins. She's not admitted that. I'm not talking about Katie Hopkins as a kind of, in a way, example of a satire. But when she was invited to Brunel University, many students just went there, sat there. The moment she started to speak, they turned their back and left the room in protest without making any fuss or without kind of, in a way, making any noises or switching the laptop off as a way to preventing her to speak and so on and so forth. And again, it's the context is kind of, in a way, quite important. Let me give you another example. And this is something which comes up again and again in the context of, let's say, debates about hijab in Europe as well as in Iran and the rest of the Middle East. And I've had this discussion with many colleagues and many, many people so many times. And they always present it as to be the exact opposite. Here you have a regime which forcefully, kind of in a way, pushes women to cover themselves as much as possible, yes? And the example of the France is actually presented as the exact opposite, yes? My take would be, in both cases, I'm not kind of in a way comparing in any way, please don't misunderstand me, a democracy with a kind of in a way authoritarian state by any means. But my assumption would be, I think there are kind of any significant similarities because in both cases, it is actually the state which determines what women are allowed to wear or not to wear. That actually what is lost here is a kind of, in a way, women's control over their body in terms of actually to what percent, to what extent they can cover themselves or not cover themselves. So sometimes even though stuff might appear to be the exact opposite, one is done in the name of Islam, the other one in the name of kind of, in a way, secularism and laicity, but effectively there are a kind of, in a way, infringement on people's right. I don't want to kind of, in a way, cover my head, but maybe there are some people who are actually kind of, in a way, doing it. So it's actually recognizing the context that not all the debates about Muslims is exactly the same. If you're a woman in Saudi Arabia, it's very different from being a Muslim woman in Paris or in Marseille or perhaps in Bradford and in Washington and so on and so forth. So I think that context is quite important.
Can I come back on that?
Just very briefly, yes, yeah.
The context is this, and I've worked on it for 30 years. I've made a film about war crimes where one of the people that I named as a war criminal has been tried in a tribunal abroad. He ran death squads in 1971 in Bangladesh. He was one of the leaders of the Rushdie campaign and belonged to an organization called the Jamaat-e-Islami. They don't have state control in democracies, but they're exercising massive community control and pressure. And the French state actually took the voices of French women who were being raped, French women, Muslim women who were French citizens, who were being raped in the suburbs in the banlieue. And I know many of those women because I worked with them. And freed them from the pressures that they were having in the school. I mean, whether it should be banned on the streets and so on, I think is another issue. But to say it's different and it's just the democracies working there, in that case, the French democracy, and yes, there is a racist discourse as well, but there's also a discourse which is usually wiped out of women who are put under that pressure and the threat of gang rape and actual gang rapes, and who are saying this is what's happening to us because we who don't cover are then seen as slags and sluts and so on, which is exactly what's happening with the grooming scandal there. So there are multiple pressures and there are multiple groups, including some of the same groups either backed by Iran or Saudi Arabia, that are operating at a community level. And I don't think we should wipe out the fact that they're here and they're operating here.
I'm not, okay, at all.
Okay. Okay, another question. There's one there. Right, just... Okay.
Hi, thank you all. You're all really fascinating stuff to say. I wanted to ask about what you think of the internet's role in satire, just if you could say a bit more about that. All of you kind of mentioned responses to it. Martin, you particularly spoke about comment sections and sort of jumping into those and what. And I was wondering, because I mean, in a lot of ways, the internet is incredibly globally expansive. It means that we can forge connections internationally in a way that was completely unprecedented, but it also enables us to kind of curate what we see. So, for example, your Facebook feed is probably filled up with people who think relatively similar to you because we are friends with people who share our values, which kind of leads to situations where we are maybe lured into a false sense of security in terms of who people are going to vote for or whether or not they agree with us, and it kind of limits our understanding of the world at large. And I'm kind of thinking of when there was a sort of massive outcry against Trump actually visiting Britain and people saying, you know, we shouldn't let him in. But then obviously what satire does is it takes things that people find offensive and it ridicules them. And my feeling personally is that by pretending something doesn't exist or, you know, not engaging with it, it doesn't, well, it doesn't mean it's not there, it still is, it's just you're choosing not to engage with it. And I really liked what you said, Martin, about, you know, choosing not to, you know, choosing not to engage with this shit, which is, I think, really, really true. But do you think that these sort of, I mean, do you think the internet is counterproductive in that way? I mean, is it, are comment sections a good thing?
No, I think comment sections are the spawn of Satan and should be closed down immediately. I think that the, in order to, well, I was almost the other day, I almost went down to our local betting shop to put money on humanity screaming out for the internet to be closed within the next 10 years before we actually commit species suicide. Just all of us just slit our throats rather than bear any of this crap any longer. We'd miss the cat gifts a bit, but we'd just be infinitely better if we closed it off. As far as I was concerned, in the immediate effect of the internet, when The Guardian started putting mine and Steve Bell's stuff on their website in 2001, when the American liberal media collapsed in the face of the Bush administration and The Guardian website really took off, suddenly I had more people reading my cartoons potentially than had read The Guardian hitherto over the previous 180 years put together. And also I had a massive increase in the number of death threats I got from total strangers around the world. Now, death threats by email don't really count. You need one of your loved ones' ears to your home address, by and large. But nonetheless, just screaming rage and fury from around the world about anything. Just to see a cartoon of mine, didn't bother about the context, they just saw it, and they wanted to kill me. And for the most part, that's just taunting. It's just pantooting, the chimps pantooting over a disputed bit of territory. The consequences of the internet means that newspapers, where my craft has appeared for 117 years on a daily basis, of the 300 years of the thriving of British cartoons, there's only a third of it. Obviously, it's the next medium for visual satire. We will, like any sensible parasite, jump off our dying host and go on to something else. I'm encouraged in another way, having just denounced the whole thing, I'm encouraged in another way. For example, about 10 years ago, there was an Iranian cartoonist who had done a cartoon for a local, a provincial Iranian paper of an Iranian politician who was very pious and had just bought a local football team. And he just did a caricature of him with his foot on a football, but gave him this mark in the middle of his forehead to show his piety because he was praying five times a day. And this man dragged the cartoonist in front of a Sharia court, sentenced him to 40 lashes. And almost instantly, we were able to start a global campaign and just invited cartoonists to draw this particular Iranian politician who nobody had ever heard of previously in far worse ways. And he was so horrified by this, he actually rescinded the charge and it was never carried out, which was a result. We achieved the same thing with my Turkish colleague, Musa Kart, 5 years ago. Sadly, Musa has now been sentenced by Erdogan to almost 3 years in prison because apparently he's a terrorist. He started annoying Erdogan when he drew him as a cat in 2005 and was fined a huge amount of money. The point about the internet, it is merely an amplifier and accelerant to the dark side of human interaction, which we'd be carrying on anyway. It's just we can all fucking hear now.
I suppose what I'd also add is that I feel like sometimes the... obviously, the echo chamber of Facebook is a real thing, but it is also slightly overstated in that pre-internet, you'd still curate your reading materials, that you'd pick the newspapers that you wanted to buy, you talk to people that you want to talk to largely, and go to talks that you want to go to. So I think the internet... It's not such the big echo chamber that we might think it is, and like things are sent globally, and that's changed the way that satirists have to think about things because you have to be more aware that you're addressing a different audience, you're addressing a global audience, not just a Guardian readership or whoever else.
I mean, sort of that said, in the 1930s there were riots in Kashmir after Sir David Lowe, the great political cartoonist, did an entirely innocuous cartoon about how Ron Bradman yeah, Rob Bradman, the cricketer, was now in the Global Hall of Fame, and he was a statue, and next to him was the Prophet Muhammad, in a sort of a nice cartoony way. Nothing, just, he was just there as a great man, and there were riots in Kashmir as a response to that. And that was, it must have taken them about a week to get the paper over there to find this out. So.
Ella, do you think that just on this subject of the internet, do you think that the internet, as someone who's now undertaking really important efforts to try and change the gender balance within the kind of political cartooning world, do you think the internet has helped with that?
Yes, in a way, because women are able to publish without having to be sort of hired. You can disseminate your cartoons all over the internet, but it clearly hasn't changed the amount of women who are hired by print publications. So with WIP, I decided not to. I do post some cartoons on the internet, but we don't have a website as such. It's not an online magazine, and that was because the point that I was trying to make is that women should be hired as sort of for print publications. As well as being able to sort of share their things freely on the internet.
Thanks. Maybe we've got time for one more question. There's a question there, the gentleman there in the white shirt.
On a similar theme regarding the internet, you guys all kind of brought up rights to free speech, rights to offend, and also touched a little bit on platforming, like who has a platform to disseminate their material. I was just wondering how that intersects with the, like, technical change towards the internet, and to give an example that I think might illustrate this, a couple of months ago there was a controversy about whether it is offensive to call a particularly pink-faced Brexit-supporting man a gammon or not, based on the Question Time audience, essentially. And perhaps 20 years ago, a newspaper cartoonist could have, drawn these people as a ham, and then the audience, chooses to buy that newspaper or not, chooses to read that cartoon or not, chooses to identify with that or not, and then chooses to be offended or not. Whereas now, if I go, I agree people like this are gammons, I can go onto Twitter, search particular key phrases, and then reply to them and say, you're a gammon, and get rid of that entire, like, decision-making process, and invade their space. So how does, like, my right to say those things change when I can, like, do it directly to someone rather than kind of putting it out into the published ether, as it were?
Well, I think it should be covered by the same law that would cover you if you actually sought out a gammon pub. There must be special clubs for these people to go to, I imagine, and go in there and start being horrible to them, that they would probably call the police and have you thrown out. And I sort of rather think the same thing. You know, people will say I'm targeting offence at poor billionaires and people who run countries and how cruel that is. But I'm part of a very long tradition which has been, for the most part, tolerated, certainly in this country and in thankfully in most other parts of the world, in some degree or other. But this pretense at dialogue of people screaming at each other. Back in the day, we had a kind of filtration for this, and it was called the landlady. You'd throw you out of the pub. And it was much better then.
I think it's really, really important, but I'm kind of, in a way, ambivalent about the whole kind of, in a way, situation. At some points, I completely agree with Martin. It has been a disastrous kind of, in a way, situation with the outpouring of so many things. My colleague, Becky Gardiner, who used to be the comment editor for The Guardian. She last year did a research on looking at kind of millions and millions and millions of comments, some of them deleted, some of them still on. And not really surprisingly, the most hateful, the most horrendous kind of, in a way, comments and abuse were targeted at mostly either women's writers and journalists or people who were specifically talking about some hot topics, Palestine, of course, issues to do with racial equality and so on and so forth. So there has been a kind of, in a way, barrage of kind of, in a way, attack, lots and lots of nasty things happening. But at the same time, I would actually kind of, in a way, grant, so just that the online environment, I mean, we talked about the access and you mentioned the idea of kind of, you know, with these amazing critical pamphlets emerging, I would actually suggest some of the online spaces more or less actually have acted in the same way as George Orwell describes the kind of, in a way, the idea of the pamphlet in a particular kind of, in a way, time in British history. So there are more access. That actually, that has lowered the barrier of access for a number of commentators, for a number of people to come and comment and talk about it. What actually worries me in particular when we talk about and when we talk about the kind of, in a way, the internet and what can be done about it, there is a very, very interesting report which was published last year by UNESCO on hate speech online. And one of the kind of recommendations was that the government should actually intervene and try to regulate it. It's one of those things which really, really worries me for two reasons. One, I think I think many people, when they look at kind of individual commentators, the people coming after the pop drunk or some teenagers or some people who might not be particularly bright putting comments on Twitter and Facebook, in focusing on those kind of individuals, we usually kind of in a way forget how the powerful individuals across the globe spread the nastiest messages again and again and again and again. So we actually had abuse long before internet. There is a paper called The Sun. There is something called Daily Mail. All the stuff about kind of, in a way, fake news and that sort of stuff. Actually, we had them long before anybody else had it in the UK and probably elsewhere. So in relation to kind of, in a way, what appears online, I think one of the things which actually worries me that there are things we ignore and we neglect, and they carry far more kind of, in a way, weight politically and globally speaking. Trump is one of them. But just give you, Trump is an easy target. Let's focus on the wonderful, amazing, sweet, liberal Macron. Last year, he came and actually did a kind of, in a way, talk about the problems of Africa. And he identified Africa actually producing too many children as the main cause of Africa's problem. Not colonialism, nothing to do with French state whatsoever. It was that hyper-sexuality of Africans which produces all the problems. I'm thinking, that is offensive. That is basically reproducing one of the most horrendous racial stereotypes we've had. And because he's the president of the France, he can actually get away with it, and it's actually broadcast and amplified. So there is a different forms of amplification which is taking place. The second issue of God, and these are the people in charge, the second issue of that, actually, when you kind of anyway ask states to intervene, and I'm not kind of anyway against it, I think there are certain rules on hate speech, on or whatever actually can be said or cannot be said, which are quite important and essential. But this idea of actually inviting governments to do some polishing for us and some tidying up for us reminds me, since actually you've done the graphic novels of the Communist Manifesto, I just wanted, there is a really important passage in Marx's critique of the Goethe program, which I think probably is the most cantankerous thing he's ever written. And in one of the kind of way line, he critiques the Goethe program saying, well, it's the role of the state which should come and educate the citizens. And he said, what? The states need educating by the citizens themselves. So I think there is a kind of way, different ways of actually looking at that, that there is a tension taking place pretty much in an online environment as it is in the offline environment. And we need to be kind of in a way careful exactly, despite recognizing the problems and the issue, we need to kind of in a way navigate our way around kind of in a way those issues which are really undermining the degree of kind of in a way freedom and the possibilities of creative kind of in a way networks emerging.
Just to clarify what I said about you going round to the Gammon Club and screaming in their faces, I wouldn't have as much of a problem with you doing that as if you did it wearing a ski mask. And actually, that's one of the most odious things about social media, is the anonymity of most of the people involved, because I think they think it's happening in their heads, and I think they think there's no consequence. It's just the sort of terrific drivel pouring through their brains. And it doesn't matter what they say, blah de blah de blah. And I just take away their anonymity. Just it's quite simple. You can say whatever you like. And if you say things which are libelous or fall foul of various laws, then so be it. You will be prosecuted. But we know who you are. Because otherwise, you know, in all other circumstances, people know who you are. And there are certain occasions where you shouldn't know who you are, so if you're a whistleblower. But then just mouthing off like a drunk in a pub to a global forum, why hide?
Ella, do you want to respond to that question? Okay, thank you all for coming, and in particular, thanks to the three speakers, Ella, Martin, and Golem, for what's been a really fascinating session. Thanks.